From New Orleans, the Dirty Dozen Brass Band featuring Public Enemy's Chuck D, you'll hear later on, with What's Going On, echoing the sentiments of Marvin Gaye's famous protest against government indifference to the consequences of war and poverty and white supremacy. It's the title track from the Dirty Dozen Brass Band's 2006 release, a scathing commentary on government inaction after the devastation caused by Hurricane Katrina in August of 2005. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and today we'll take a look at what we began discussing last week. Actually, we've been discussing this now as a series, taking a look at how killer cops are getting away literally with murder, and their trials showing a disturbing prosecutorial trend. Attorney at law Alton H. Maddox Jr., who in the series he has been pointing out to us the legal underpinnings, how these things happen and why they happen, and he has been on point, 1,000% absolutely accurate on predictions based on his own experience of more than 40 years as a litigator, especially in cases involving police brutality, misconduct, and lethal use of force, and in confronting systems that refuse to budge and that provide all kinds of cover for rogue cops. He's here with us again today to take a look at several high-profile cases associated with police killings of unarmed people, and looking particularly at this disturbing trend, the trend of errors, prosecutorial and judicial errors that appear to compromise the integrity of the prosecutor's cases, and therefore often resulting in no convictions. Thanks, Alton, for being with us once again.
Thank you for the invitation, Utrice.
Well, I want to start with a case that we discussed last week with another attorney, and this attorney was representing a client, David Ayers, in Cleveland, Ohio. David Ayers was a security guard and wrongfully charged and convicted of murder, for which he spent almost 12 years in prison. He's a gay man, and the evidence, in fact, showed that he didn't do this. He did not commit this murder at all. The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals voided his conviction in 2010, and he was free to go almost a year after that. And a federal court then awarded him in 2013 $13.2 million as compensation for his wrongful conviction. And the city of Cleveland did something very interesting. The city of Cleveland spent taxpayers' money, according to Ruth Brown, who I interviewed last week. She is one of Mr. Ayers' attorneys. She said that the city of Cleveland actually spent taxpayer money to help the police officers against whom judgments also were proffered against them, as well as the city, but the city helped them, hired attorneys to help them file for bankruptcy so that Mr. Ayers would not be able to collect from them. And the city now is also saying that it does not have any obligation to pay Mr. Ayers for his wrongful conviction. Now, when I talked with Ruth Brown, she used the word unprecedented. She said this, to her knowledge and to the research that she and her firm had done into this matter, this move by the city of Cleveland is unprecedented. Of course, they are challenging it. But she also said that she believes it to be something of a template that would probably pop up all over the country, where major judgments are now being won against cities in cases involving police brutality and certainly lethal use of force. And the families are winning, in some cases, rather hefty judgments against the city and against police officers involved. And it was her belief that this may be the beginning of a strategy by cities against whom judgments are won to void those judgments by subterfuge. It was important to note, and I did in the interview with her, that the city of Cleveland had the dubious distinction of coming under direct federal scrutiny and, in fact, had signed a consent decree some years ago agreeing to do something to fix its notorious police department. What do you think about this move by the city of Cleveland assisting the police officers into declaring bankruptcy so that even when a judgment is made against them by the court, by a jury, and upheld by an appellate court, they have a strategy for not paying?
Well, you know, Therese, what I would like to do, because it doesn't seem as though too many people are listening to me, although they may be listening to the program, and when I say certain things, because the thing that I have always said seemed never to materialize, and that's what's frustrating when you can make these predictions, you know exactly what the strategy is, know exactly what the tactics are, and then we'll sit somewhere and listen to somebody who is an in-charge Negro rather than a take-charge Black to explain to us why whatever I say should be ignored. So I want to start again by saying this. White supremacy only speaks two languages, and they are legalese and military science. Those are the only two languages they understand, and anybody who is unable to understand or speak either language is forever lost. So if we start with that proposition, then the next thing I've always said to these grassroots organizations is that no organization is really a real organization unless it has, one, an attorney, two, an accountant, and three, a professional secretary. If those three things do not exist, it is a bogus organization, and it is engaged in bogus operations. Now, having said that, it is no question that it would be correct for anybody to say that this is an unprecedented chartered course of action, because it is. That does not mean it can be ignored, however, because there was a time when Plessy versus Ferguson was litigated in the last part of the 19th century. And the issue was one of whether segregation was permissible under equal protection of the law. And so it would seem as though that if you have a segregated society under a constitution that guaranteed equal protection of the law, that there would be a slam dunk. And so anybody who was discussing that would not have any reason to believe that the Supreme Court of the United States would sanction segregation under the 14th Amendment. And I always cite this is one of the leading cases, because in order to understand white supremacy, you really have to understand the leading cases. And I've always said, and I say again, that you have to have law books. That's the tools of the trade. And so, again, any organization that does not have a law library is faking itself and faking you. And you certainly should not be making any contributions to such an organization. If they want to put the name Alton Maddox on the organization, they are operating as an outlaw operation. And so when Judge Henry Brown got a chance to write the opinion in the Plessy versus Ferguson, his opinion in effect said to black people, don't believe your lying eyes. And so, you know, he went on to say that there's no segregation here other than what your lying eyes is telling you. And so we went from 1896 to 1954 with unchallenged segregation. And then it took another 2 years in the case of Gale versus Browder to outlaw Jim Crow totally. So, you know, we're talking about now a situation where the municipalities in Ohio are required to identify, indemnify a police officer for judgment as the one that was incurred in the wrongful conviction and incarceration of Ayers out in Cleveland. And now you have the police departments and other agencies saying, well, we're not going to pay it because we have protection under the bankruptcy laws. And so this is as ludicrous as the position that was taken in Plessy versus Ferguson. But history shows us that it is capable of repeating itself, and therefore the question becomes, what are we going to do as a people not to go back into slavery? And so I think this particular case is one of those telltale signs of us going back into slavery, and going back into slavery without anybody challenging how we are going back into it. And then we see these other situations like the one in Flint, Michigan that's going on now. And then we see the Oscars, and we see the large number of black men who have been shot down in the street, even though dogs can walk the street, even pit bulls can walk the street, and nobody pull out a gun and shoot them. So, you know, the real question now is really, what are we going to do about it? And I certainly would like to entertain, you know, the IRS question, but, you know, we need to entertain it within the backdrop, you know, that I just gave.
Well, Cleveland's position is that the judgments were not, in fact, against the city, but against the police officers, and therefore it does not have an obligation to pay.
Well, the fallacy of that argument is that nobody, if you assume that that is the truth, then if a police officer who will not go bankrupt because the state is still going to indemnify him for his wrongful ways, the question becomes, then why are you doing this in the first place?
Well, we have a ready reference for that, and that was in 2014. I'm sure you remember the case of two people whose car backfired as they passed a police station, and a chase ensued and ended with 137 shots being fired by police at the two occupants of the car, who, of course, were completely innocent of anything. And the city of Cleveland paid or agreed to pay a total of about $3 million in that case. Now, it is interesting that even so, when the city of Cleveland has on the record that it does have an obligation to pay as provided by the law as compensation, and $3 million is really, you know, if we were to discuss this in strict terms, $3 million for the lives of two innocent people just shot down 137 bullets, it's nothing. But the feeling, of course, is, hey, look, if they were to live their lives fully, they would never have made $3 million. So here's $3 million and we get rid of this case. But I'm asking that a city with that record can't have it both ways. In one instance, they say, okay, we will pay the families $3 million because we recognize our duty and obligation here because they were killed by City of Cleveland police officers. And now they're saying in the case of David Ayers, who has won a judgment in the court, and the Court of Appeals affirmed that judgment, and a federal jury affirmed that judgment, the city is now taking a different tact. What do you think accounts for that?
Well, you know, one of the things that you learn in going to law school, because I doubt whether some of these lawyers out here ever went to law school. They may have gone to some trade school, because if they had gone to law school, we wouldn't have to be dealing with as many questions that we're having to deal with now. But be that as it may, for those who truly went to law school, and it seems like I may be one of the very few who have done that, it would seem as though you would make a distinction between cases. And so, you know, putting on my lawyer's hat, the distinction I would try to explain between the fusillade of bullets that came out in the case that you had mentioned and what has happened in the Irish case now is one of hush money. And I use the word hush money in this way. When you fire over 100-something bullets at two unarmed persons, you are violating international law and the Geneva Conventions. And so in a case like that, you will clearly be entitled to go to the United Nations, to the World Court, to seek some real justice. I would imagine that Cleveland is saying that we're willing to give you $2 or $3 million in a case like this because we really appreciate the fact that you did not go to the World Court or to the United Nations, and therefore we'll give you the $3 million. However, in the case of Ayers, who has chosen not to go to the World Court, and our conduct has not been such that would give rise to violations under the Geneva Conventions or any other international law, we will stick to our guns and say that we're simply not going to pay it because as long as you stay within civil rights and don't move over into human rights, then we have a way of addressing this issue. And this was one of the arguments that Malcolm X made, is that, you know, in a lot of cases, and the atrocities that have been visited upon us, we should be seeking remedies under human rights, and we didn't. And my argument would be that while it is a very twisted argument to claim that we can now go into the bankruptcy court to clear us of any financial obligations, I would suggest that that is exactly what is happening here, because the reality of it is that you're talking about indemnification, and certainly nobody's going to lose any money as a result of that. So you're not concerned about money here. You're concerned about principles and the right of white supremacy, and to maintain that at all costs, even if we have to use twisted argument to do it, as we had to do earlier in the case of Plessy versus Ferguson.
Well, let's stick again. We're in Ohio still, because there's a lot of stuff going on in Ohio that seems to be part of a legal template. Just last Thursday, we had a judge basically, after a grand jury decided not to indict two police officers for the killing of 12-year-old Tamir Rice, we find out that, in fact, the prosecutor did not present that charge to the grand jury, but instead had the grand jury decide whether the police officer, the police officers involved, including and especially the one who shot Tamir Rice, whether he was justified in using that level of force and not to consider any other crimes against him. So here we have a question of the role of the prosecutor in basically aiding and abetting the exculpation of a person directly responsible for the death of a 12-year-old. And the grand jury revealed that it never was asked to vote on any charge against the officer. So this, first, could you talk about what this raises, the specter that this raises on a prosecutorial level of prosecutorial misconduct? Is this misuse of the grand jury? Is this proof that the prosecutor, Timothy McGinty, had misused the grand jury process?
Well, you treat, and I want to answer that question because, you know, when people hear this and you talk, you need to be able to talk with examples because, you know, too many times we hear people come on radio and they talk, but they don't talk with any examples. And so it credibility, I mean, you know, it certainly could be accepted, but then on the other hand, you know, it could be challenged if you don't have the examples to go along with what you tending to advocate. And so in this scenario that you just brought up, which is a very important scenario, very important in terms of what happened in grand jury actions, what I did in practicing law, and I think I have told people this earlier, in terms of writing a manual on how to effectively represent the black defendant, that I never saw any rule that said you couldn't engage in collective bargaining before the grand jury. I've never read that rule, that you couldn't collectively bargain with the grand jury. And so when we were able to demonstrate to Cuomo and to Grady up in Dutchess County.
This is Governor Mario Cuomo.
Mario Cuomo. In the Brawley case, you know, the one thing that I had told him was, is that whoever he thought that he wanted to appoint, that would be collective bargaining. In the same sense that you would collectively bargain in labor agreements, and in the sense that even though it is fictitious, you know, the way that you were supposed to be engaged in plea bargaining. So I saw no rule that said you couldn't engage in collectively bargaining before the grand jury. And so with that in mind, you know, that's what we were sitting there doing, going down to Abrams' office for about 3 weeks, engaging in collective bargaining over how the grand jury process was going to work. And so in the course of that, we were able to get a few things done. One, for the first time ever in the history of New York, we were able to pick a grand jury publicly so that people could be present and could hear the question that was asked of the grand jurors and see any objection that may be made to those particular grand jurors and all of that, which was unprecedented again. And so, you know, we had a situation where it still obviously did not work out, but nonetheless, it was a breakthrough in the right direction. So what is going on in Ohio is that there have been no demands to engage in collective bargaining at all in any way. And there's no way in the world that you can allow a secret grand jury to get a case and do an investigation without you first establishing the ground rules right from the beginning, including the right to give certain appropriate grand jury instructions to the grand jurors. So, you know, I'm saying that only because I think that we have to write out our own course of action in these kinds of cases. And instead of waiting on legislators to outline rules for grand jury investigation, we have to do our own. And I don't think at this point we are not doing that, you know. So I want to say all of that, you know, in addition to, you know, the question that you asked about, you know, what was going on in Tanir Rice's case and how they could, on one hand, not put certain charges before the grand jury. But that's something that should have been worked out. If you were engaged in collective bargaining, that would be one of the things that you have on the table. This is what we want this grand jury to consider.
But doesn't this raise very serious questions about the use of the grand jury by the prosecutor? If, in fact, the prosecutor had basically announced that the grand jury saw no reason to indict, what the prosecutor didn't say was he never presented the case at all on any serious charges, but in fact that the grand jury ended up deciding what I would consider to be a departmental issue as to whether the police officer who shot and killed Tanir Rice acted within departmental guidelines. Now, to my knowledge, that is not what the grand jury should be used for. So
no, you're right.
The question is, who is going to compel an investigation of the use of this grand jury by Timothy McGinty, the prosecutor?
Well, you know, one of the things that's interesting here is because at some point, you know, the people themselves have to assume some responsibilities. I mean, you know, you can't get involved in a case, want to see justice done in the case, and then you decide the only thing you want to do is be a spectator and deal with, on the sideline with any criticism that's being made of an attorney one way or the other, rather than you being on the field and actually being a part of the game plan. And so, you know, that's one of those things that, you know, I had to deal with in terms of practicing law, because every time I came out, there will always be a lot of criticism. And unfortunately, a lot of people not knowing legalese and won't learn legalese. I mean, this is the whole thing. You know, we won't even learn it. You know, if we do learn it, we want it to be free. You know, we want you trees to set up the lead story. We want other people to set up things so we can learn that way, rather than say, I'm going to make an investment in learning legalese and learning the military science. And so, you know, what happens is that you just get overwhelmed by the critics and then by the grievance committees who come behind them and basically, you know, wipe you out. But you're absolutely right. I mean, somebody has to be able to sit and say to the prosecutor, we want to know what charge you're going to present. I mean, that's a basic question. You know, and the idea to think that people would say, well, they're going to have a grand jury investigation, we don't know what the contours of that investigation are, and we don't know what the subject of the investigation is, it's ludicrous. And you're absolutely correct when you say that. The question becomes, who has the courage and the temerity to say it won't happen until we know these things are going to happen. And that's the only way you can safeguard yourself in a situation like that. I mean, it's crazy for a prosecutor to say later, well, you know, we weren't even considering that in the first place.
Well, it is compounded now because a judge who oversees county grand juries in Ohio, that including the one that decided that they saw no reason to indict the police officers involved in the killing of Tamir Rice, has now formed a committee to review the process, but not to find wrongdoing, but simply to make it more efficient.
And that's exactly what that is step two. If you know, if too much heat is to put on people in the first instance, is to do what this judge is doing. You know, that's exactly what they do to provide relief by not providing relief. You know, and that become a part of the process. And you know, the serious thing about this, though, let's look at it this way. The reality of it is, most of us are hard pressed to just stay on top of who the local city council person is, you know, who the local judge is, you know. But when you start getting into the real legal process, I mean, we don't really pay attention to who's going to sit on this bench or who's going to sit on that bench or whatever. You know, we just don't do that. So, you know, the point of it is they understand that the farther away that you get from the people, the more damage you can do to the people.
He's still in Ohio. There's yet another case that came to my attention, and that's the case of a black man killed not by a regular police officer, but a university police officer. And his name was Samuel DeBose, was 43 years old, and the father of 12 children. He was shot at point-blank range by a campus police officer, Ray Tenzing, during a traffic stop. And although Tenzing seemed to have lied about the situation, the circumstances, a camera footage disputed everything he said and showed that he, as they say, purposefully killed the driver, Samuel DeBose, 43 years old. Now, the university responds as follows. It will offer the family of Mr. DeBose $4.85 million for the fact, as compensation for the fact that its own police officer actually did the shooting and killing of Mr. DeBose. And they will throw in tuition-free education for his 12 children when they should become of college age. Now, what is really outrageous here about this is that we haven't seen the prosecution yet of Officer Tenzing, and the murky issue here, Carlton, and I want to address this, is really what rights do campus police now have in policing communities, including, up to and including, shooting and killing people in the neighborhood?
Well, first, you know, we're talking about the University of Cincinnati. And so we're comparing that to the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office in Ohio, you know, in terms of their responsibilities. And, you know, basically it's clear that those rights that a university police officer has certainly would not and could not and should not measure up to the rights of a member of the Cincinnati Police Department. And so what those special officers can do would be described in Ohio statutes, but you certainly would not expect them to rise to the level of shooting somebody, and you certainly wouldn't expect them to rise to the level of the police officer basically saying, "I'm just I have the same rights that any ordinary citizen have to bring down Du Bois." Because that would not be rational either. So, you know, that examination would start with the rights and privileges that these special police officers have, and certainly they would not be beyond the confines of the area of the University of Cincinnati. And so, you know, the first question would become whether he was doing something that was in line with, you know, the protection of the University of Cincinnati and its environment. And I don't think that he could even prove that he was doing that. So I think that he was really just taking the law into his own hands and then falling behind this particular statute as a shield to any prosecution. And I think the question that you raised is very pertinent. Is what is the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office doing itself, and whether it's just it also going to have behind a settlement to exonerate this police officer or immune this police officer from any grand jury investigation?
We also have the overarching question of the, I think, the widening of the perimeter of authority to kill people. Because now we have essentially a campus police officer having the same rights and the authority of a trained police officer of a police department. Is it clear that the university has no further obligation here other than to say, well, we're sorry that one of our security people shot and killed your father and husband. Here's a $4+ million, and hopefully they'll give you some, free tuition, and that should settle the matter. Or should we? Is there a policy, a standing policy about
how? Okay, I tell you what you're asking really is whether the laws of agency applies to a university. And so, you know, if the laws of agency do apply and this cop has to be recognized as an agent of the University of Cincinnati, then the question becomes whether entering into a settlement with a family to receive hush money should be extended to the entire death. And I don't think it should be. I mean, that's really what the bottom line is, because if the University of Cincinnati sits down and agree to give some family hush money, that should not exonerate or immunize the university from criminal culpability, because this guy was an agent of the University of Cincinnati. And the question becomes, what is the prosecutor's office going to do in light of that stipulation? And that's the reason why, you know, I always tell people that you have to see each one of these cases as a class action. In other words, the mere fact that it was not your child does not mean it should not be your concern. And that, you know, when these things happen, the entire class of people similarly situated must become aroused and later may possibly have to take some action against the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office. And that's where we are now, where, you know, basically they just want to ride this throughout. And, you know, and hopefully, you know, people get amnesia at some point, go to sleep, and forget all about the fact that this happened in the first place.
Well, we had talked repeatedly about how legal back doors are open when you have cases where police officers are charged with killing people, and a whole different set of rules, a whole different approach now would come into play, and the sole purpose of it would seem to be the protection of the officer's rights and not justice in behalf of the victim or victims. Mm-hmm. In and all of these cases that we are talking about today are in Ohio. So, and Ohio had come under Eric Holder's Justice Department scrutiny and had been warned and had agreed to clean up its act. But apparently it didn't seem to apply to them once he left. And the new U.S. Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, I would say that, you know, we're seeing a pattern here, but we are not hearing anything from the Justice Department. No concern about this, neither at the state level nor the federal level.
And that is correct. And, you know, one of the things I said, and this was several years ago, and when Elliot Spitzer was the New York State Attorney General, certain things were happening, and I kept saying, well, New York City Police Department has to be put into receivership. And so, you know, Spitzer said, no, well, that's not something that's appropriate here. And apparently, you know, our people just believe Spitzer and certainly did not believe me. And so that never happened until such time as an incident happened up in Wallkill, New York. And in Wallkill, it was shown that members of the Wallkill Police Department were stopping white women and was harassing them. And there was a practice and pattern of this conduct, and it had seemingly been sanctioned by the local law enforcement agency in Wallkill. And as a result of that, Spitzer, for the first time, filed an action placing the Wallkill Police Department in receivership. And this is what, you know, I've been saying all along with all these cases, is that when you have intervention by the federal government in a case like in Ferguson, Missouri, or in a case like in Cleveland, Ohio, or in Chicago, that the idea of federal monitors is inadequate. That's not an adequate relief and adequate remedy. And that the approach in those kind of cases would be to turn around and place the entire department into receivership, and you run it yourself. And so, you know, when you start getting these outlaw policemen like the one up in Cleveland who wants to hide behind the bankruptcy laws, or you get the cop of the University Police Department in Cincinnati who want to hide behind a stipulation. With these monitors, you know, if you look, these monitors who should be receivers, you know, can then turn around and look at that and say, no, we're not doing that. These things are not appropriate, which shows that the idea that the federal government would use monitors anyway in cases like this is something that must be addressed by us as a people, and to send the message that, no, this conduct merits more than just having a federal monitor. It merits having a federal receiver and somebody who is going to manage the affairs of this police department until such time as it demonstrates that it is capable of independently managing its own affairs.
What has to happen for that to happen? What is the legal process by which that comes about?
Well, the legal process would really be what a federal intervention on behalf of the people themselves, because these cases, when they are resolved in favor of a monitor as opposed to a receiver, happen that way because there's no one challenges it and asking for something more appropriate than what the court permits. And so, you know, this is another one of those situations where when you're existing out here, you have to have a battery of attorneys who are capable to go to these very war scenes, you know, and correct these injustices. because the federal judge, if he doesn't have anything else on his plate other than the federal government's request for the appointment of a monitor, then we all lose by default because we didn't show up and we didn't make any additional arguments. And these courts are not going to just in a very charitable manner come up with a relief that may be more appropriate, but one that has not been demanded by the people.
Now, the circumstances of each of these cases, the circumstances are different, but the outcome seems to be remarkably the same, and that is the system prevails. It appears or it gives the appearance that justice is being done, but we see when we peel back the scab here, we see the festering sore that basically calls for, it's a kind of alarm. When the system itself, the prosecutorial system, and as we saw in the case that I talked about where the judge forms a review panel not to find out why the prosecutor never placed before the grand jury charges to consider having to do with the actual shooting death of a 12-year-old boy, but instead had the grand jury think about whether the shooting was within departmental guidelines for the use of lethal force, and then lies publicly. No heads are rolling. Nobody is being charged. Nobody is being put in jail. Nobody is being censored. Nobody is being fired. You can't help but say, well, you know, that's the way this system intends to work. And without a protracted struggle here and competent challenge, it will continue to do exactly the same. So one would not be out of one's mind to say that what we are seeing here is, in fact, a template for how these cases are handled with the decision made beforehand, that by every means necessary, the police officers are not to pay for their crimes.
Well, you know, one of the things that what we really are able to hear through your program is this, our knowledge of communications law is very limited. And, you know, oftentimes when you have a problem like this, repetition is the key. But the repetition means repetitive public affairs programming as opposed to arts and entertainment programming. And, you know, and people want to listen to what you're saying here on this program or getting the benefit of public affairs and not arts and entertainment, which is generally what is given to us. And so as a result of that, we leave the program without any questions being raised. And here, you know, you're raising some very serious questions that should be posed to other people and required that they be answered. And so that this is a step in the right direction for those who really want to understand what this public educational process is all about and why we have to constantly be vigilant and why we have to follow in the footsteps of people like Mega Evers, who really fought against censorship and for the right of public affairs to be disseminated in Mississippi.
Well, Alton, I want to thank you for the benefit of your experience and your knowledge and for sharing it so generously with us so that we could understand what we are observing. You know, going back to your phrase, do you believe me or your lying eyes? I mean, this is what we're being asked, you know, to always believe that our eyes are lying to us. And it's playing, you know, these awful tragedies are unfolding before our very eyes. And yet we are encouraged to believe that these are just unconnected, very unconnected cases. And each case is so unique and the circumstances are so unique and you can't begin to link them at all, let alone begin to see the big picture here. But I encourage people to remember the speech I played of Martin Luther King just last Monday when he said that the ultimate goal of white supremacy is genocide. And when you understand this system, it is, in fact, a goal that people are singled out to be treated in a particular way. And yes, they will say, well, we have a courts and we have a fair system. You listen to all the folder all that they preach around this time of year, the presidential races. But the fact is, the system has remained remarkably impervious to change and remarkably comfortable with the idea that if it does come at all, it will come at the expense of Black and Latino and the life and the lives of people it considers dispensable and politically unprotected. So I want to thank you once again for coursing us through this thinking of understanding the nuts and bolts, the legal nuts and bolts of these cases, which seem unconnected, but in fact are part of a large story. Thanks so much for being with us today.
And I want to thank you, Yusheese, for giving me and the community a platform to know better and then to do better.
Thank you so much. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. Four cases in one state, and these are very high-profile cases, and we ought to be linking these things by now and seeing the big picture and seeing how a system behaves with a predictable outcome, and they see to it that the outcome is predictable. Now, people in this presidential year want to get all romantic about we, the American people. No, time and again, the system says we are not the people. There are some of us who are and some of us who are not. So I thank you for joining me today. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know how you are reacting to this program. And as always, it's a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company, and I thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
What's going on when all them guns is drawn? Here's a memo. Remember, there's a few wars going on. A couple overseas and on my front lawn. When common sense was common and now it's all gone. What's going on? And that's going on. And what's going on? And that's going on. And what's going on? And that's going on. And that's going on. And that's going on.